it from his father, so it must be true.
I looked across the lake, finding it hard to believe the entire body of water hadn't existed 100 years earlier. Everything surrounding it, trees, rocks, the opposite shore shimmering in the distance, felt like it had always been there.
Did your grandfather really make the lake?
He did indeed. He saw this land and knew what it needed, a lake. Because God had failed to put one here, he made it himself. One of the first people to do that, I might add.
Franny inhaled deeply, as if trying to consume every scent, sight, and sensation the lake provided.
And now it's yours to enjoy any way you'd like. You do enjoy it here, don't you, Emma?
I thought I did. I loved it here 2 days ago, before Vivian took me out in the canoe to her secret spot. Since then, my impression of the place had been chipped away by things I didn't quite understand. Vivian and her moods, Natalie and Allison's blind acceptance. Why the thought of Theo continued to make my knees weak even after I humiliated myself in front of him. Unable to let Franny know any of this, I simply nodded.
"Wonderful," Franny said, beaming at my answer.
"Now, try to forget about the unpleasantness in your cabin. Don't let anything spoil this place for you. I certainly don't. I won't let it."
23. I wake with the dawn, my fingers still curled around the broken bracelet. Because I spent the night clenched with worry, my lower back and shoulders hurt, the pain there beating as steadily as a drum. I slide out of bed, shuffle to my trunk, and dig out my bathing suit, towel, trusty robe, and drugstore sunglasses. On my way out, I do a quick check of the door. Nothing new has been painted there. I'm grateful that, for now, seeing Vivian again is the worst of my worries. After that, it's more shuffling to the latrine, where I change into the bathing suit, then to the lake, and finally into the water, which is such a relief that I actually sigh once I'm fully submerged. My body seems to right itself. Muscles stretch, limbs unfurl, the pain settles to a mild ache, annoying but manageable. Rather than full-out swim, I lean back in the water, floating the way Theo taught me. It's a hazy morning, the clouds as gray as my mood. I stare up at them, searching in vain for hints of sunrise, a blush of pink, a yellow glow, anything to take my mind off Vivian. I shouldn't have been surprised by her appearance. Honestly, I should have expected it after 3 days of nonstop thinking about her. Now that I've seen her, I know she'll return, yet another person watching me. I take a deep breath and slip beneath the lake's surface. The colorless sky wobbles as water comes between us, rushing over my open eyes, distorting my vision. I sink deeper until I'm certain no one can see me, not even Vivian. I stay submerged for almost 2 full minutes. By then, my lungs burn like wildfire and my limbs involuntarily scramble for the surface. When I emerge, I'm hit once again with the sensation of being watched from a distance. My muscles tighten, bracing for Vivian. On shore, someone sits near the water's edge, watching me. It's not Vivian, thank God. It's not even Becca. It's Franny, sitting in the same grassy area Becca and I had occupied 2 mornings ago. She still wears her nightgown, a Navajo blanket wrapped around her shoulders. She waves to me as I swim back to shore.
"You're up early," she calls out. "I thought I was the only early riser around here."
I say nothing as I dry myself with a towel, put on the robe, and slip on the sunglasses. Although Franny appears happy to see me, the feeling isn't quite mutual. With Vivian now fresh in my thoughts, so too is her diary. I'm close to finding out her dirty little secret. That line, the appearance of the camera, and Franny's noticeable lack of support after Mindy accused me of vandalizing my own damn door have left me in a state of deep mistrust. I'm debating whether to walk away when Franny says,
"I know you're still upset about yesterday, with good reason, I suppose. But I hope that doesn't mean you can't sit with an old woman looking for a little company."
She pats the grass next to her, a gesture that squeezes my heart a little. It makes me think I can forgive the camera and her failure to rush to my defense. As for Vivian's diary, I tell myself that she could have been lying about Franny keeping secrets. Being dramatic for drama's sake, it was, after all, her forte. Perhaps the diary was just another lie. I end up brokering a compromise between my suspicious mind and my squishy heart. I sit beside Franny, but refuse to engage her in conversation. Right now, it's the best I can do. Franny seems to intuit my unspoken rules and doesn't press me for details about why I'm up so early. She simply talks. "I have to say, Emma, I'm envious of your swimming ability. I used to spend so much time in that lake. As a girl, you couldn't get me to leave the water. From sunrise to dusk, I'd be out there paddling away. Not anymore, though. Not after what happened to Douglas." She doesn't need to elaborate. It's clear she's referring to Douglas White, her much older husband, the man who died years before she adopted Theo and Chet. Another piece of Vivian's diary snakes into my thoughts. "Don't you think it's strange that a dude who almost made it to the Olympics drowned?" I push it away as Franny keeps talking. "Now that my swimming days are over, I observe," she says. "Instead of being in the lake, I watch everything going on around it. Gives you a new perspective on things. For instance, this morning I've been keeping an eye on that hawk." Franny leans back, putting her weight on one arm. The other emerges from her blanket and points to a hawk lazily circling over the lake. "Looks like an osprey," she says. "I suspect he sees something he likes in the water. Once, years ago, two peregrine falcons made their nest right outside our living room window at the Harris. Chet was just a boy at the time. My word, was he fascinated by those birds. He'd stare out that window for hours, just watching, waiting for them to hatch. Soon enough, they did. Three eyesses. That's what falcon chicks are called. They were so small, like squawking, wriggling cotton balls. Chet was overjoyed, as proud as if they were his own. It didn't last long. Nature can disappoint as easily as it entrances. This was no exception." The osprey overhead suddenly dives toward the lake and, wings spread wide, slices its feet through the water. When it rises again, there's a fish gripped in its talons, unable to escape no matter how much it wriggles and flops. The osprey swoops away, heading to the far side of the lake where it can eat in peace. "Why did you reopen the camp?" I blurted out, surprising even myself. But Franny was expecting it, or at least a question similar to it. She pauses long enough to take a breath before replying. "Because it was time, Emma. 15 years is too long for a place to stay empty."
"Then why didn't you do it sooner?"
"I didn't think I was ready, even though the camp was right here waiting for me."
"What convinced you that you were?"
This time there's no pat answer at the ready. Franny thinks it over, her eyes on the lake, jaw working. Eventually she says, "I'm about to tell you something, Emma. Something personal that very few people know. You must promise not to tell another soul."
"I promise," I say. "I won't say a word."
"Emma, I'm dying." My heart feels squeezed again, harder this time, like it, too, has been scooped up by that osprey. "Ovarian cancer," Franny says. "Stage 4. The doctors gave me 8 months. That was 4 months ago. I'm sure you can do the math.
But there must be something you can do to fight it.
The implication is clear. She's worth millions. Certainly, someone with that much money can seek out the best treatment. Yet Franny gives a sad shake of her head and says,
It's too late for all that fuss now. The cancer's spread too far. Any treatment would only be a way of delaying the inevitable.
I'm stunned by her calmness, her serene acceptance. I'm the exact opposite. My breath comes in short bursts. Tears burn the corners of my eyes, and I hold back a sniffle. Like Vivian, I now know one of Franny's secrets. Only it's not dirty. It's sad, and makes me think of that sundial hidden away in the forest. That last hour truly does kill.
I'm so sorry, Franny. Truly, I am.
She pats my knee the way my grandmother used to.
Don't you dare feel sorry for me. I understand how fortunate I am. I've lived a long life, Emma. A good one, and that should be enough. It is, really. But there's one thing in my life that wasn't fortunate.
What happened here, I say.
It's troubled me more than I let Theo and Chet know, Franny says.
What do you think happened to them, to Vivian and the others?
I don't know, Emma. I really don't.
You must have some theory. Everyone else does.
Theories don't matter, Franny says. It's no good dwelling on what happened. What's done is done. Besides, I don't like being reminded of how much that disappearance cost me in so many ways.
That's a sentiment I can understand. Camp Nightingale was forced to close. Franny's reputation was sullied. The taint of suspicion never entirely left Theo. Then there was the matter of three separate lawsuits filed by Vivian's, Natalie's, and Allison's parents, accusing the camp of negligence. All three were settled immediately for an undisclosed sum.
I wanted to have one last summer of things being the way they used to be, she says. That's why I reopened the camp. I thought if I could do that successfully, with a new mission, then it might ease the pain of what happened 15 years ago. One last glorious summer here. And then I could die a content woman.
That's a nice reason, I say.
I think so, Franny replied. And it would certainly be a shame if something happened to spoil it.
The ache in my heart fades to numbness as yet another thing Vivian wrote in her diary commands my thoughts. She definitely suspects something.
I'm sure it won't. I try to sound chipper when I say it, hoping it hides the sudden unease overcoming me. Everyone I've talked to is having a great time.
Franny tears her gaze away from the water and looks at me, her green eyes untouched by illness. They're watchful, probing, as if they can read my thoughts.
And what about you, Emma? Are you enjoying your time here?
I am, I say, unable to stare back. Very much.
Good, Franny says. I'm so pleased.
Her voice contains not a hint of pleasure. It's as chilly as the slight breeze that gusts across the lake and ripples the water. I pull my robe tight around me, fending off the sudden cold, and look to the lodge, where Lottie has emerged on the back deck.
There you are, she calls down to Franny. Is everything okay?
Everything's fine, Lottie. Emma and I are just chatting about camp.
Don't be too long, Lottie says. Your breakfast isn't getting any warmer.
You should go, I tell Franny, and I should probably wake the girls in Dogwood.
But I haven't finished my story about Chet and the falcons, Franny says. It ends not long after those birds emerged from their eggs. Chet was obsessed with them, as I've said, spent all his free time watching them. I think he truly grew to love those birds.
But then something happened that he wasn't prepared for. Those Iases got hungry, so the Mother Falcon did what Mother Falcons are known to do. She fed them. Chet watched her leave her perch outside our window and fly into the sky, circling until prey appeared. It was a pigeon. A poor, unsuspecting pigeon, probably on its way to Central Park. That Mama Falcon swooped down and snatched it in midair. She brought it back to the nest by our window, and as Chet watched, she used that sharp, curved beak to tear that pigeon apart and feed it to her babies, piece by piece. I shudder as she talks, picturing flapping wings and downy feathers floating in the air like snow.
"You can't blame that Mother Falcon," Franny says matter-of-factly. "She was simply doing what she needed to do, taking care of her children. That was her job." But it broke Chet's heart. He watched those squawking little Iases too closely, and they showed their true natures. Some of his innocence was taken away that day. Not much, just the tiniest bit. But it was a part of him he would never be able to get back. And although we don't talk about those falcons, I'm certain that he'd say he regrets watching them closely. I think he'd say that he wished he hadn't looked so much. Franny climbs to her feet, struggling slightly, the effort leaving her body quivering. The blanket slips and I get a peek at her rail-thin arms. Pulling the blanket around herself, she says, "You have a good morning, Emma." She shuffles away, leaving me alone to contemplate the story of Chet and the Falcons. While it didn't sound like a lie, it also didn't quite have the ring of truth. It might have been, I realize, with another robe-tightening chill, a threat. 24. The morning painting class is spent in a state of distraction. The girls arrange their easels in a circle around the usual still-life fodder, table, vase, flowers. I monitor their progress with disinterest, more concerned with the bracelet that's once again around my wrist. I'd managed to fix the clasp with some colored string from Casey's craft station. A stopgap measure, I suspect, won't last until the end of the day, let alone the rest of the summer. Not the way I'm constantly twisting it. I'm made nervous by all the activity drifting through the building like a tide. Becca and her budding photographers marching in from the woods, Casey and her crafters stringing slim leather necklaces with beads. All these girls, all these prying eyes. And one of them knows what I did 15 years ago, a fact I'm sure I'll be reminded of sooner rather than later. I give the bracelet another tug as I stand next to Miranda, examining her work in progress. When her gaze lingers on my wrist, I pull my hand away from the bracelet and look out the window. From the Arts and Crafts building, I have an angled view of the lodge, where various members of the Harris White family come and go. I see Mindy and Chet bickering about something as they head to the mess hall, followed by Theo trotting past on a morning jog. A minute later, I spot Lottie gingerly guiding Franny toward the lake. Right now, the lodge is empty. Franny's story returns to me, whispering in my ear. He watched them too closely, and they showed their true natures. I know I should heed her warning. This won't end well. Even if I do get answers, there's no guarantee my conscience will rid itself of guilt. But I'll never know if I don't try. Not knowing is what brought me here. Not knowing is why I kept seeing Vivian all those years ago. It's why I saw her last night. This is my only chance. I need to take care of something, I tell the class. I'll be right back. Keep painting. Outside, I slip away to Dogwood and retrieve my phone and charger. I then make my way to the lodge, moving at an awkward half-run, torn between being inconspicuous and being speedy. In truth, I need to be both.
At the lodge, I knock on the red front door, just in case someone returned during my jaunt to the cabin and back. When seconds tick by and no one answers, I give the doorknob a twist. It's unlocked. I check to see if anyone is nearby and possibly watching. No one is. Quickly, I tiptoe inside and close the door behind me. Then it's through the entrance hall and living room before veering left into the study. The room is roughly the same size as Dogwood, with a desk in the center and floor-to-ceiling bookshelves where our bunk beds would be. The wall behind the desk is covered with framed photographs. There's an air of neglect about the place, like a museum that's not very good at upkeep. A thin layer of dust covers the Tiffany lampshade on the desk. There's a thicker coat of it on the rotary phone, which looks like it hasn't been touched in years. I lower myself onto my hands and knees, searching the walls for an outlet. I find one behind the desk and plug in the phone charger. Then I stand in the middle of the study, wondering where to look first. It's hard to decide without Vivian's diary to guide me. I recall her writing about how she managed to sneak something out of the study, which means there could be multiple possible clues here. I head to the bookshelf on my left, which holds dozens of thick, musty volumes about nature. Darwin's On the Origin of Species, Audubon's Birds of America, Walden by Thoreau. I grab a thick purple book and examine its cover. Poisonous Plants of North America. A quick flip through its pages reveals pictures of lacy white flowers, red berries, mushrooms colored a sickly green. I doubt these books are what Vivian was referring to. I turn next to the desk, giving its phone, lamp, and blotter calendar a cursory glance before reaching for the three drawers stacked from floor to desktop. The first drawer is the usual menagerie of pen caps and paper clips. I close it and move to the middle one. Inside is a stack of folders. They bulge with documents, their edges brittle with age. I flip through them. Most appear to be receipts, financial statements, invoices for long-ago work on the property. None contain a hint of scandal. At least nothing that Vivian could suss out during a brief bit of snooping. In the bottom drawer, I find a wooden box. It's just like the one Vivian showed me during our outing to the other side of the lake, only better preserved. Same size, same surprising heft. Even the initials carved into the lid are the same. C.C. Charles Cutler. The name slips into my head without warning or effort. One look at those initials and it's right there, summoned at will. I lift the box from its hiding place and carefully turn it over. On the bottom are four familiar words, Property of Peaceful Valley. I turn the box back over and open it, revealing a green velvet interior. Nestled inside are photographs, old ones, of women in gray with long hair draped down their backs. Each one assumes the same pose as Eleanor Auburn, minus the clutched hairbrush. This is where Vivian got that picture. I'm certain of it. It's merely one of what appears to be two dozen. I sort through them, unnerved by their uniformity. Same clothes, same bare wall background, same eyes made dark by despair and hopelessness. Just like the one of Eleanor, the back of each photo has been marked with a name. Henrietta Golden, Lucille Tawney, Anya Flaxen. These women were patients at Peaceful Valley. The unfortunates whom Charles Cutler rescued from squalid, crowded asylums and brought to Peaceful Valley. Only I have a gnawing suspicion his intentions weren't so noble. A chill settles over me, increasing with every name I read until I'm practically numb. Auburn, Golden, Tawney, Flaxen. Those aren't last names. They're hair colors. I'm struck by a dozen different thoughts, all clashing together in my brain. Scissors in that crumbling box, the broken glass sound they made when Vivian turned it over. Watching Allison's mother in that guilt-inducing production of Sweeney Todd. A character sent to bedlam at the mercy of wardens who sold their hair to wig makers. That's what Charles Cutler was doing. It explains these women's long locks and why their last names went unwritten, as if the only important aspect of their identity was the color of their hair. It makes me wonder if any of them knew the purpose they served, that they weren't patients but commodities, ones who surely saw none of the money Charles Cutler received from wig makers. The idea is so distractingly sad that I don't realize someone has entered the lodge until a voice rings out from the entrance hall. Hello? I drop the photos back in the box and quickly replace the lid. The motion sets the charms on my bracelet clicking. I press my wrist against my stomach to silence them. Is someone in here? The voice calls. I am, I say, hoping it will cover the sound of me closing the desk drawer. Emma Davis. Springing to my feet behind the desk, I find Lottie in the doorway. She's surprised to see me. The feeling is mutual. I'm charging my phone. Mindy told me I could do it here if I needed to. You're lucky Franny's not here to see you. She's a stickler about such things. Lottie sneaks a glance behind her, making sure Franny is indeed elsewhere. Then she creeps into the room with a conspiratorial gleam in her eyes. It's a silly rule, if you ask me. I warned her that girls are different now than they were back then. Always glued to their phones. But she insisted. You know how stubborn she can be. Lottie joins me at the desk, and for a heart-stopping second, I think she knows what I've been doing. I brace myself for questions, perhaps a thinly veiled threat similar to the one Franny offered this morning. Instead, she focuses on the framed photographs cramming the wall behind the desk. They seem to have been placed there in no discernible order. Color photos mingle with black and white ones, forming a wall-size collage of images. I spot a grainy picture of an imposing man in front of what I presume to be Lake Midnight. A date has been hastily scrawled in the picture's lower right corner. 1903. That's Franny's grandfather, Lottie says, Buchanan Harris himself. He has a hugeness so many important men of that age possessed. Big shoulders, big belly, big, ruddy cheeks. He looks like the kind of man who could make a fortune stripping the land of its trees and then spend that money creating a lake just for his personal enjoyment. Lottie points to a bird-like woman also in the photo. She has big eyes and Cupid doll lips and is dwarfed by her husband. Franny's grandmother. I heard she drowned, I say. Childbirth. Lottie replies. It was Franny's husband who drowned. How did it happen? The drowning? That was before my time. What I heard is that Franny and Douglas went for a late-night swim together, like they did every day. Nothing strange about that. Only on that particular night, Franny came back alone. She was hysterical, carrying on about how Douglas went under and never came back up. That she searched and searched but couldn't find him. They all went out in boats to look for him. His body wasn't found until the next morning, washed up on shore. The poor man. This place certainly has seen its fair share of tragedy. Lottie moves on to another black-and-white one, showing a young girl leaning against a tree, a pair of binoculars around her neck. Clearly Franny. Below it is another photo of her, also taken at the lake. Rendered in the garish colors of Kodachrome. She's a few years older in this one, standing on the lodge's deck, her back turned to the water. Another girl stands beside her, smiling. There she is, Lottie says. My mother. I take a step closer to the photo, noticing the similarities between the woman posing with Franny and the one standing at my side. Same pale skin, same Betty Davis eyebrows, same heart-shaped face that tapers to a pointed chin.
Your mother knew Franny?
Oh, yes, Lottie says. They grew up together. My grandmother was the personal secretary to Franny's mother. Before that, my great-grandfather was Buchanan Harris's right-hand man. In fact, he helped create Lake Midnight. When Franny turned 18, my mother became her secretary. When she passed away, Franny offered the job to me.
Is this what you wanted to do?
I'm aware of how rude the question sounds, like I'm judging Lottie. In truth, I'm judging Franny for continuing the Harris tradition of using generations of the same family to make their own lives easier.
Not exactly, Lottie says with unyielding tact. I was going to be an actress, which meant I was a waitress. When my mother died and Franny offered me the job, I almost turned it down. But then I came to my senses. I was in my 30s, barely scraping by, and the Harris Whites have been so kind to me. I even think of them as family. I grew up with them. I've spent more time here at Lake Midnight than Theo and Chet combined. So I accepted Franny's offer and have been with them ever since. There's so much more I want to ask. If she's happy doing the same thing her mother did, if the family treats her well, and most important, if she knows why Franny keeps photos of asylum patients in her desk.
I think I see Casey in this one, Lottie says farther down the wall at a spot of pictures of Camp Nightingale during its prime. Groups of girls posing on the tennis court and lined up at the archery range, bows pulled back.
Right here, with Theo. She points to a photo of the two of them swimming in the lake. Theo stands waist-deep in the water, the telltale lifeguard whistle around his neck. Cradled in his arms, in the exact way he cradled me during my swimming lesson, is Casey. She's slimmer in the picture, with a happy, youthful glow. I suspect it was taken when she was still a camper here. Just above that picture is one of two girls in polo shirts. The sun is in their eyes, making them squint. The photographer's shadow stretches into the bottom of the frame like an unnoticed ghost swooping down on them. One of the girls in the photograph is Vivian. The other is Rebecca Schoenfeld. The realization stops my heart cold, just for a second or so. In that pulseless moment, I stare at the two of them and their easy familiarity. Wide, unforced smiles, skinny arms tossed over shoulders, keds touching. This isn't a photo of two girls who barely know each other. It's a picture of friends. I should go, I say as I quickly gather my phone and charger. You won't tell Franny about this, will you? Lottie shakes her head. Some things Franny's better off not knowing. She also starts to leave, skirting around the desk and giving me roughly 2 seconds to lift my phone and snap a picture of Vivian and Becca's photo. I then hurry out of the room, exiting the lodge the same way I came. At the front door, I literally bump into Theo, Chet, and Mindy. I bounce between the brothers. First Theo, then Chet, who grabs my arm to steady me.
"Whoa there," he says.
"Sorry," I say, holding up my phone. "I needed a charge." I push past them into the heart of camp. The morning lessons have ended, and girls drift among their cabins, the mess hall, and the arts and crafts building. When I reach Dogwood, I find the girls inside, indulging in some reading time. A comic book for Crystal and an Agatha Christie paperback for Miranda. Sasha flips through a battered copy of National Geographic.
"Where did you go?" Crystal says. "You never came back."
"Sorry, I got tied up with something." I kneel in front of my hickory trunk and run my hands over the lid, feeling the ridges of all the names that had been carved before mine.
"What are you doing?" Miranda asks.
"Looking for something."
"What?"
Sasha says. I lean to my right, my fingers tripping down the side of the trunk. That's where I find it, 5 tiny letters scratched into the hickory, a mere inch from the floor. B-E-C-C-A. A liar, I say. 15 years ago. Campfire, 4th of July. There was a change in the air that night. A combination of heat, freedom, and the holiday. The campfire seemed higher, hotter. The girls surrounding it were louder, and, I noticed, happier. Even my group of girls. Whatever had caused the earlier drama in Dogwood was resolved by dinner. Vivian, Natalie, and Allison laughed and joked through the entire meal. Vivian said nothing when Natalie had an extra helping. Allison, astonishingly, cleaned her plate. I simply felt relieved that Franny was right. The storm had passed. Now they surrounded me beside the fire, basking in the orange warmth of the leaping flames. "We're sorry about earlier," Vivian told me. "It was nothing." "Nothing," echoed Allison. "Nothing at all," added Natalie. I nodded, not because I believed them, but because I didn't care. All that mattered was that they were with me now, at the end of my lonely day. "You're best friends," I said. "I understand." The counselors handed out sparklers, which we lowered into the campfire until they ignited into starbursts. Sizzling, white hot. Allison climbed to her feet and sliced the sparkler through the air, forming letters spelling her name. Vivian did the same, the letters massive, hovering there in streaks of sparks. A distant boom drew our attention to the sky, where golden tendrils of fireworks trickled to nothingness. More replaced them, painting the night red, then yellow, then green. The fireworks promised in the nearby town, only we at Camp Nightingale could also see them. Allison stood on one of the benches to improve her view. I stayed on the ground, pleasantly surprised when Vivian embraced me from behind and whispered in my ear, "Awesome, right?" Although it seemed as though she was talking about the fireworks, I knew she was actually referring to something else. Us. This place. This moment. "I want you to always remember this," she said, as another bloom of color streaked through the sky. "Promise me you will." "Of course," I said. "You've got to promise, Em. Promise me you'll never forget." "I promise." "That's my little sister." She kissed the top of my head and let me go. I kept my eyes on the sky, enthralled by the colors, how they shimmered and blended before fading away. I tried counting the colors, losing track as explosion after explosion erupted in the distance. The big finish, all the colors commingling until the sky grew so bright I was forced to squint. Then it was over. The colors vanished, replaced by black sky and pinpoint stars. "So pretty," I said, turning around to see if Vivian agreed. But there was no one behind me, just a campfire slowly reducing itself to glowing embers. Vivian was gone. 25. I skipped the campfire again, using tiredness as an excuse. It's not entirely a lie. All this being watched and sneaking around have left me exhausted. So I slip into comfortable clothes, a t-shirt and a pair of plaid boxers worn as shorts, and sprawl out in my bottom bunk. I tell the girls to go have fun without me. When they leave Dogwood, I check my newly charged phone for an email from Mark regarding his research assignment. All I get is a text reading, "Mr. Library is still adorbs. Why did I ever break up with him? XOXO. I text back, "Stay focused." A few minutes later, I'm back outside and heading to another cabin, Golden Oak. I wait by the door until a trio of campers scurry out on their way to the campfire. Becca is the last to emerge. Her body goes rigid when she sees me. Already she knows something is amiss.
"Don't wait up. I'm right behind you," she tells her campers before turning to me and, in a far less friendly voice, says, "Need something, Emma?"
"The truth would be nice." I hold up my phone, revealing a photo of a photo. Her and Vivian, their arms entangled, inseparable.
"You feel like sharing this time?"
Becca nods, her lips pursed, and retreats back into the cabin. When a minute passes and she doesn't emerge, I start to think that she simply intends to ignore me. But she comes out eventually with a leather satchel slung over her shoulder.
"Supplies," she says. "I think we're going to need them."
We cut through the cabins and head to the lake. It's the thick of twilight, the sky tilting ever closer from day to night. A few stars spark to life overhead, and the moon sits low in the sky on the other side of the lake, still on the rise. Becca and I each take a seat on rocks near the water's edge, so close our knees practically touch. She opens the satchel, removing a bottle of whiskey and a large folder. She opens the bottle and takes a deep gulp before passing it to me. I do the same, wincing at the whiskey's sharp burn in the back of my throat. Becca takes the bottle from my hands and replaces it with the folder.
"What's this?"
"Memories," she says. I open the folder and a stack of photographs spills onto my lap.
"You took these?"
15 years ago. I sort through the photos, marveling at how talented she was even at such a young age. The pictures are in black and white, stark, each one a spontaneous moment caught on the sly and preserved forever. Two girls hugging in front of the campfire, silhouetted by the soft focus flames. The bare legs of someone playing tennis, white skirt flaring, exposing pale thighs. A girl swimming in Lake Midnight, the water up to her freckled shoulders, her hair as slick as a sea lion. Allison, I realize with a jolt. She's turned away from the camera, focused on something or someone just out of frame. Beads of water cling to her eyelashes. The last photograph is of Vivian, a lit sparkler in her blurred hand, spelling her name in large slashes. Becca had set the exposure so the letters could be seen, thin white streaks hanging in midair. V.I.V. 4th of July, 15 years ago, the night they vanished.
"My God," I say, "this could be..."
"The last picture ever taken of her? I think it is."
The realization makes me reach for the whiskey. The long gulp that follows creates a soft, numbing sensation that helps me ask, "What happened between you and Vivian? I know you stayed with them in Dogwood the year before I came to camp."
"The four of us have a complicated history."
Becca stops to correct herself.
"Had a complicated history. Even outside of this place. We all went to school together, which wasn't unusual. Sometimes it felt like half our class came here in the summer."
"Camp Richbitch," I say. "That's what it was called at my school."
"Mean," Becca says, "but accurate, because most of them were indeed bitches. Vivian especially. She was the ruler, the queen bee. People loved her. People hated her. Vivian didn't care as long as she was the center of attention. But I got to see a different side of her."
"So you were friends?"
"We were best friends. For a time, anyway. I like to think of Vivian as my rebellious phase. We were 14, pissed off at the world, sick of being girls and wanting so badly to be women, Viv especially. She was perfect at finding trouble. Rich boys who'd get her anything she wanted. Beer, weed, fake IDs she'd use to get us into all the clubs. Then it suddenly stopped."
"Why?"
"The short answer, because Vivian wanted it to."
"And the long answer?"
"I'm not entirely sure," Becca says.
I think it was because she went through some fucked-up identity crisis after her sister died. She ever tell you about it?
Once, I say. I got the sense she didn't like to talk about it.
Probably because it was such a stupid death.
She drowned, right?
She did.
Becca takes another swig from the bottle before pressing it into my hands.
One night in the dead of winter, Catherine, that was her name in case Viv never told you, decided to get shit-faced and go to Central Park. The reservoir was frozen over. Catherine walked out onto it. The ice broke. She fell in, never came back up.
I'm struck by the memory of Vivian pretending to be drowning. Her sister had to have crossed her mind as she flailed in the water and gurgled for help, all to get a boy's attention. What kind of person does that?
Catherine's death absolutely crushed her, Becca says. I remember running to her apartment right after it happened. She was crazed, Emma. Wailing, pounding the walls, shaking uncontrollably. I couldn't look away. It was ugly and beautiful at the same time. I wanted to take a picture of it, just so I'd never forget. Yeah, I know that's weird.
But it's not.
At least not as weird as making the same three girls continually vanish between layers of paint. That was the beginning of the end of us, Becca continues. I did the best friend thing and went to the wake and the funeral and was by her side when she came back to school. But even then, I knew she was pulling away from me and being drawn to them.
Them?
Allison and Natalie. They were Catherine's best friends. All three were in the same class.
I always thought they were the same age as Vivian, I say.
She was a year younger, although you couldn't tell from the way she acted.
Becca reaches over and takes the bottle from my lap, choosing the particular poison she needs to get through the conversation. She takes a long gulp and swallows hard.
They found comfort in one another. I assume that was the appeal. Honestly, before Catherine died, Viv wanted nothing to do with them. You should have heard the way she made fun of them whenever all five of us were at her apartment. We were like warring factions, even when playing something as innocuous as truth or dare.
Two truths and a lie, I say. That was Vivian's game of choice.
Not when we were friends, Becca says. I think she joined in because Catherine liked to play it. She idolized her sister. And when she died, I think she transferred those same feelings to Natalie and Allison. I wasn't surprised when I found out we'd all be bunking together in the summer. I had already assumed it would happen. What I wasn't ready for was how much I'd be left out. Around them, Vivian acted like she hardly knew me. Natalie and Allison had consumed her attention. By the time camp was over, we were barely speaking to each other. It was the same way back at school. She had them, so there was no need for me. When summer came around again, I knew I wasn't going to be bunking with them. I'm sure Vivian saw to that. I was banished from Dogwood and shuffled to the cabin next door.
It's fully dark now. Night settles over us, as does a prolonged silence in which Becca and I simply pass the bottle back and forth. The whiskey's starting to hit me hard. When I look up at the stars, they're brighter than they should be. I hear the sound of girls coming back from the campfire. Footsteps, voices, a few peals of laughter echoing off the cabin walls.
Why didn't you tell me all of this the other morning? I say. Why lie?
Because I didn't want to get into it. And I was surprised you did. I mean, Vivian treated you the same way, right?
I don't answer, choosing instead to take another gulp of whiskey.
It wasn't that hard of a question, Becca says.
Oh, but it is. It doesn't take into account the way I had treated Vivian.
No, I say, it wasn't the same. I think we're past lying to each other, Em, Becca says. I know what happened right before the three of them disappeared. I was in the cabin next to Dogwood, remember? The windows were open. I heard every word.
My heart falters in my chest, skipping like a scratched record. It was you, wasn't it? You painted the cabin door and put the birds inside, and you've been watching me. Becca jerks the bottle from my hands. I've been officially cut off. What the fuck are you talking about? Someone's been toying with me ever since I got here, I say. At first, I thought it was all in my head, but it's not. It's really happening, and you've been doing it. I didn't write on your door, Becca replies with a huff. I have absolutely zero reason to mess with your head. Why should I believe you? Because it's the truth. I'm not judging you for what you told Vivian that night. In fact, I wish I'd said some of it myself. She definitely had it coming. I stand, feeling shockingly unbalanced. I look to the bottle still gripped in Becca's hand. Only a third of the whiskey is left. I have no idea how much of that is my doing. Just stay away from me for the rest of the summer. I start to walk away, trying hard to stay upright as I call over my shoulder. And as for what I said to Vivian that night, it wasn't what it sounded like. Only it was. Most of it. All that Becca's missing is context. What she actually overheard that night. Why it happened. And how it was so much worse than she could ever imagine. 15 years ago. Where's Viv? I asked Natalie, who merely shrugged in response. Allison did the same. I don't know. She was just here. And now she's not, Natalie said. She probably went back to the cabin. But Vivian wasn't in Dogwood either, which we discovered when we returned a few minutes later. I'm going to look for her, I announced. Maybe she doesn't want to be found, Natalie said as she scratched at a new round of mosquito bites. I went anyway, heading to the latrine, which was the only logical place I thought she could be. When I tried the door, I found it locked. Strange, especially at that late hour. I took a walk around the side of the building, pulled along by curiosity. When I reached the gap in the planks, I heard the sound of running water coming from inside. The shower. Humming just beneath it was another noise. Moaning. I should have left. I knew it even then. I should have simply turned around and gone back to Dogwood. Yet I couldn't resist taking a peek. That was something else Vivian had taught me. When you get an opportunity to look, you're a fool not to take it. I leaned toward the gap. I looked. What I saw was Vivian. Facing the shower wall, her palms flat against it, breasts pressing into the wood. Theo stood behind her, hands over hers, hips thrusting, face buried against her neck and muffling his grunts. The sight of the two of them doing something I'd only heard whispered about cleaved my heart in two. It hurt so much I could hear it breaking. A sick cracking sound, like wood shattered by an axe. I wanted to run away, afraid that Vivian and Theo would be able to hear it too. But when I turned around, there was Casey, a lit cigarette dangling from her lips. Emma? Smoke pushed from her mouth with each syllable. Is something wrong? I shook my head, even though tears had already started to leak from my eyes. The movement set them free, flinging them away from my face. You're upset, Casey said. I'm not, I lied. I need to be alone. I slipped past her, running not to the cabin, but to the lake, where I stood so close that water lapped at my sneakers. Then I cried. I had no idea for how long. I just wept and wept, the tears falling directly from my eyes into the water, mixing with Lake Midnight. After crying so much that my tears ran dry, I returned to Dogwood, finding Vivian, Natalie, and Allison all there. They sat in a circle on the floor, smack in the middle of a game of two truths and a lie. In Vivian's hand was the flask she had told me about. Its existence truly wasn't a lie. Now she took a slow drink from it, as if to prove how foolish I had been to doubt her. "There you are," she said, holding out the flask. "Want a swig?" I stared at her damp ponytail, her pinkened skin, her stupid locket. And at that moment I despised her more than I had despised anyone in my life. I could feel the hatred boiling under my skin. It burned. "No," I said. Allison continued with the turn I had interrupted. Her choices were, as usual, either self-aggrandizing or stupid. "One, I met Sir Andrew Lloyd Webber. 2, I haven't consumed bread in a year. 3, I think Madonna's version of Don't Cry for Me Argentina is better than Patti LuPone's." "The second one," Vivian said, taking another hit of the flask. "Not that I care." Allison flashed a chorus girl smile, trying not to act hurt. "Correct. I had pancakes this morning, and my mother made me French toast the morning I left for camp." "My turn," I announced. 1, my name is Emma Davis. 2, I am spending the summer at Camp Nightingale." I paused, ready for the lie. 3, I didn't just see Vivian and Theo fucking in the latrine showers." Natalie slapped a hand over her gaping mouth. Allison shrieked, "Oh my God, Viv, is that true?" Vivian remained calm, looking at me with a dark glint in her eyes.
"Clearly that upsets you."
I turned away, unable to endure the hardness of her stare, and said nothing. Vivian kept talking. "I'm the one who should be upset by this situation, knowing that you were spying on me, watching me have sex like some pervert." "Is that what you are, Emma? A pervert?" Her calmness was what ultimately got under my skin. The slow way she spoke, so deliberate, accented with just the right amount of disdain. I was sure she did it on purpose, lighting the fuse that would eventually make me explode. I gave her what she wanted. "You knew I liked him," I screamed, the words raging forth, unstoppable. "You knew and couldn't stand the thought of having someone pay more attention to me than to you, so you fucked him because you could." "Theo?" Vivian laughed, a single, short, disbelieving burst. It was the cruelest sound I'd ever heard. "You actually think Theo is interested in you? Jesus, Em, you're just a baby." "That's still better than being a bitch like you." "I'm a bitch, but you're delusional. Truly fucking delusional." Had any tears been left in my body, I'm certain I would have started crying on the spot. But I'd used them all up. All I could do was push past her and crawl into bed. I laid on my side, my back turned to them, knees pulled to my chest. I closed my eyes and breathed deeply, trying to ignore the horrible, hollow feeling in my chest. The three of them didn't say anything else after that. They went to the latrine to do their gossiping, sparing me the humiliation of having to listen. I fell asleep not long after they left, my brain and body deciding together that unconsciousness was the best remedy for my misery. When I woke, it was the middle of the night. The creak of the floorboard was what roused me. The sound jolted me awake and propelled me upright. Light from the full moon outside slanted through the window in a gray-white beam. Each girl passed through it, shimmering a moment on their way out the door. First Allison, then Natalie, and finally Vivian, who froze when she saw me awake and watching. "Where are you going?" I asked. Vivian smiled, although no amusement could be found in that slight upturn of her lips. Instead, I sensed sadness, regret, the hint of an apology.
You're too young for this, Em, she said.
She raised an index finger and pressed it to her lips, shushing me, conspiring with me, requesting my silence. I refused. I needed to have the last word.